Welcome to the Sharks MTG podcast, a somewhat competitive-focused South African Magic the Gathering podcast. At the moment, I think we are the only South African podcast, which also technically makes us the best South African podcast. It also technically makes us the worst. How's it going, Karan Chetty? You are my co-host. It's myself, Bob Perfect, on the line, if you didn't know that already. But how's it going, Karan?
Thanks for clearing that up. I wasn't sure who was calling, Bob.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm a little, I've been doing a lot of stuff at the moment, bro, so I'm a little frazzled, if I'm not going to lie to you here.
Yeah, you've been busy?
Yeah, I've, done, three podcasts already this week, so I'm just, I've been so used to being on the mic at the moment and just chatting to people. I might call you the wrong name at some point on this podcast, and I might be talking about music and some other topic entirely if I bring up the wrong notes.
Hey, listen, man, I like music. That's okay. We can talk about that as well if you want.
But yeah, how you doing, bro? How's everything going?
Yep, quarantine life is not without its challenges, and eagerly waiting the president's announcement this evening to see, what's the state of the economy and whether our businesses can start resuming again. And that's obviously a stressful, very stressful and, weighing quite heavily at the moment. So, yeah, Magic's been a welcome relief, I guess.
I've seen you've been having some struggles there online at the moment when it comes to all of this. So, yeah, I'm also hoping for your sake and for a lot of people listening's sake, that things are relieved a little bit and we can safely do some things. I don't know what that is. I don't know enough. I'm just going to wait and see and then read everyone's analysis tomorrow and then make up my mind about what I actually have an opinion on here. But we have a guest once again on the MTG Sharks podcast, and it is another returning guest. Who do we have today, Karan?
We have Anthony Hodgson back once again. Welcome, Anthony.
Thanks very much. I'm very excited, and the previous time I wasn't made aware that it's the best podcast in the country, so I'm much more excited this time.
Much more excited this time. I like it. You've been quite busy online. I see you've been jamming a lot of Magic the Gathering. You've been playing quite a bit of Limited there.
Yeah, I've played stacks and stacks of drafts. I really, really love this set. I think it's the best draft set we've had in quite some time, although I think all the draft sets since probably War of the Spark have been amazing.
I'm with you there.
This one's a level higher than all of them, I think. So it's really great. I think it's going to have a lot of lasting value.
I agree 100% there. This has been one of my favorite draft sets probably ever. Genuinely, just for me, I haven't played the Horizons as much as Karan has and stuff like that. So this has felt really, really great to draft. But Constructed has been something else entirely at the moment. Have you had any experience with Constructed at the moment?
I played a few games of the Garuda deck at the start when everyone was going crazy about it. And I've played one or two other games with sort of random brews, but I've probably played about 10 best of threes in Constructed and hundreds in Limited. So it's,
So you've got a bit more experience to share when it comes to the Limited side of things, but a little bit with the Constructed. I've played quite a lot of both at the moment. Last week I said I was going to do some things, and then I lied straight to your faces and went straight into Blue-White Control. And I have been having a good time with it. Basically, just a lot of creature decks are out there at the moment. People are using the companions quite a bit. And so being able to just counter the companions, sweep the board, and not have any sort of win cons really in the deck other than Castle Ardenvale and the Tornado, the Sharknado, plus that Cat Elemental companion that just chills if I really need to bring in, a creature to finish. So I've been having a good time with that, but everything just seems pretty chaotic at the moment. What is your take on companions?
Me personally, I'm a little bit frustrated at the online dialogue and narrative about it. Like, there's a few things being conflated. I mean, firstly, they seem to be quite busted as a type of card in older formats. And that's like a totally separate thing to people who just play, let's say, Arena and only play Standard and Limited. I haven't seen any strong evidence to say that any companions need any kind of ban for Constructed or Limited. And I think that some of the dialogue about them is a bit exaggerated. Like, they're very powerful things, and you have to be aware of them. And most of the time, you want to be using them, certainly in Standard. But there's one point I'd make is that there's a diverse range of them. So there's 9 different companions. Yeah. And if someone told you before the start of a new Magic set, the set's going to have 9 cards that in Standard you probably have to play at least one of them, you wouldn't think that's a bad thing. Like, that's like a lot of different things you can do in a Standard format.
Sure.
But secondly, if you actually look at, I mean, I haven't played that much, but if you actually look at the results of the qualifiers and the tournaments that have been going on online, there are some decks even without companions that are doing well. There's Temur Reclamation decks that are putting up results with no companion in them. Some of the Rakdos decks don't play companions. Like, you get the small ones with the Lurrus and the big ones with the Obosh, but you also have the middle ones, which don't want to give up the Priest or the Mayhem Devil. And if you have a companion in that deck, you have to give up one of the key parts.
Are you sure there's people that just don't have the wild cards that they need?
No. The most recent, there was a Wizards post of like the top 8 in the Super Qualifier, and there was one Rakdos deck which had no companion. I mean, there's an obvious trade-off if you think about it. Like, there's a lot that's been said by professional players about the insane value of having a predictable 8th card in your hand at the start of every game.
Yeah.
But look at the Rakdos deck in particular. Like, Priest and Mayhem Devil are the best 2 cards in the deck. If you play a companion, you must cut one of those cards from your deck. Now, obviously, companion's powerful, but like, it's not that clear to me that it's powerful enough that you want to not have both Priest and Mayhem Devil in your Rakdos deck.
I hear all of that, but I feel like I'm very much on the other side of the conversation when it comes to this. More so in just what it does to the game of Magic. You know, having 8 cards in your opening hand feels ridiculous when everything, you know, lines up. Like, when your opponent starts his regular, or their regular, you know, game of Magic, and you start your regular game of Magic, it often just feels like you're not playing the same game. That's how I felt when it comes to playing certain, especially the Lurrus deck. I have tried that out a little bit on ladder, and I found it to be incredibly successful. Like, it's just being able to bring that in when you need to do it, and then start bringing stuff back, sacking stuff, dealing the damage. The utility with a lot of these can be quite, I don't think has been explored enough yet, even. Like, we're only a week into this, and things have been pretty crazy. Things have been pretty dangerous in a lot of ways. I do think that obviously the Garuda deck is not as good as people made out in the beginning, but there is also still potential for that to be broken in other ways. You know, it is a dangerous card.
But that's normal Magic, right? So, like, my point is, we have to distinguish between Magic is different. Now that we have companions, the game has changed. But is it like broken or bad in some like unfair or problematic way? That's a different question. Like, day one, people thought Garuda was broken. Then it was Lurrus. Like I said, the most recent qualifier, the Lurrus decks all got dumpstered by the Jeskai Fires decks, which are playing a companion. They're playing Karuga.
Yeah.
But even so, like, We're a week into a format where, like, the bastard companion has been a different one 3 times. What's it going to be tomorrow? Like, to me, that's a sign of a healthy developing format, not a sign of, like... Obviously, it depends. Like, if you think fundamentally the game's changing, you don't like that change, fine. But I would say it's not that different to when they first added Planeswalkers to the game. Obviously, a lot of people don't actually like Planeswalkers, but, like, it's just a new kind of card that...
Yeah, that's exactly it. That's exactly how I felt about this, is that it's like Planeswalkers. And remember when Planeswalkers came out, how many people left Magic? Like, there was a big exodus around that time. Obviously, there was economics and stuff involved as well, but people really hated that. And I don't know if companions will do that, but there is a lot of talk. There is a lot of people going, you know, like, this isn't my game anymore. This isn't what I signed up for with a lot of the cards. But that's also just older people, you know, need to adapt in a lot of ways. And yeah, I don't know. personally, I don't think it needs to be banned yet, but we don't know exactly where this is going to go. And I do just have that issue of the 8-card opening hand, essentially, of the being able to consistently always have something and always be able to do it. I don't think Magic should have that. I think you should be able to miss. I think you should need to, you know, like, even if you're playing like a bunch of cards that can fetch you what you need to get, there's an opportunity for you to lose that. And those are real deck building costs. Having to put 4 of a card into your deck to fetch another card or get you closer to another card that you really need is way different than, you know, building a deck that, like Lurrus, where it's really easy to build a deck that's full of 2 mana converted, 2 permanent spells with converted mana cost 2 or less. That's really, really easy and a strong thing to do in the first place. Yes, you want Mayhem Devil in some cases, but a lot of the decks at the moment that are super black are doing the job, you know? Like, well, that's what I've seen. But like you say, the metagame is evolving, and that's good. In terms of actual strategic play, I've been enjoying that. I've been enjoying that aspect of it. Like, for me, going into the control thing is because of, you know, all of these companions essentially making people play these creature-based decks, other than obviously the Jeskai Fires deck. Well, not the Jeskai Fires deck, the Jeskai Control deck. That's the one deck where I'm, like, losing a lot of card slots to, because I've got, like, Essence Scatters and Shadow of the Skies.
So, I mean, what do you think the Lurrus, because you mentioned that you thought it was quite easy to build around Lurrus. Like, personally, I sort of think the opposite. I think there's, like, one deck came out around it, and there's kind of a mold. But it's, I think the condition is very restricting. And I think now that there's an established deck that beats it, it's quite hard for that deck to adapt. Like, I sort of feel like the Lurrus deck has to hope that the Jeskai deck gets, pushed out by something else. Which might also happen, by the way. Like Karuga is also a restraint. Because you play Karuga, the only spells you play in your first 2 turns are the adventure spells. That's it. So if the main reason that Karuga deck works is because they aren't really punishing aggro decks right now. But you know, that's something that could change. Maybe Mono Red makes a resurgence, or maybe we wait till the next set and then there's like way more valuable aggro decks. It might even be possible for there to be a Mono White aggro deck again. Like, Mono White's recently gotten. What's that spell? 1 mana and you give 2 creatures +1 +1 and indestructible. That kind of card can be an insane counterplay against a Deafening Clarion that's supposed to like totally settle the board for a control deck.
I didn't even know that existed. I need to check that out properly then.
It's called, I think it's called Fight as One. You have to choose a human creature and a non-human creature, and they both get +1/+1 and indestructible. I mean, look, my sense from playing a lot of Limited is that certainly in Limited, there are real drawbacks to running a companion in your deck. And it varies from each companion to the next. Some of them it's easier and some of them it's harder. Right now, I'm of the opinion that I will almost never have build a Yorion as companion deck in Limited. I think that just makes your deck worse. I think that the only time I'll make Yorion my companion is if like my deck's just super bad anyway, and I might as well just like... But if you have, like, strong things you're doing with your deck, like, you really don't want to water it down like that. I think Karuga can be similar in Limited, actually, where, like, if your opponent's on the play and they curve out, you don't have that trouble. Like, constructed, right?
Yeah, so, no, I've had that happen in Limited. We can actually just, shift this into the Limited discussion, because that's going to be a large portion of what we're going to be talking about today on the podcast. Or unless you've got something to say there, Karan?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of issues here around this companion thing, and it's not as simple as saying, well, it's good or it's bad or, you know, whatever the case is. I mean, I think at a starting point, if you're looking at standard deck lists this early on, people, number one, so there's a subset of people who will just play what they were playing or cards that they had or, you know, decks that they had. And so that, you know, and those decks typically are fine because the new decks are generally unrefined. And so often the old decks would just win anyway, even though they aren't necessarily the best thing to be doing in standard in a particular time or in a format. So that's one aspect of it and why I think you will see certain older decks just be doing okay at this point. Like with the companion thing, I think you need to, as I think we alluded to it earlier, but you need to separate the issue from, well, the standard impact, which I completely agree is... nowhere near as significant as your older formats, you know, as your pioneers, your moderns, and your legacies. And if you want to, make a snap judgment based on a week or so that Companion is bad for those formats, I could completely agree with that and get around it. I mean, if you looked, I think it's the Modern Challenge and the Legacy Challenge on MTGO this past weekend. I think it was 7 out of 8 decks at both were all Companion decks in the top 8. It's really dominating those older formats because obviously those restrictions aren't really an issue. You know, Loris and Legacy, I mean, everything is cheap anyway. You know, you look at decks like Ant in Legacy or Burn in Modern. It's really easy to slot these cards in. And so I think Companion is a real problem in those older formats, or it could prove to be a real problem in those older formats. 8 cards, say what you like, but if you get to play with 8 cards versus an opponent with 7, while yes, there's deck building restrictions, and I get that, but I don't know. I'd rather be the guy who's playing with 8 cards. That seems pretty obvious to me. So, you know, I think you can leave the door open in standard and say, well, yeah, it's not Companion isn't broken in standard, probably, possibly, but it's not right. It just doesn't seem right to me that one person starts a game with 8 cards, and if you choose not to play a Companion, you only start the game with 7. That's just not right.
Hey, you get an extra sideboard slot.
It's not about the sideboard slot. It's like if your opponent decides to put Loris in their deck and you don't, they start with 8 cards, but you start with permanents that cost more than 2. That's the trade-off, right? Yeah. So I feel like, I mean, early on, I really think people are exaggerating the benefits and not looking at the cost at all. Like that's my sense of the, because the benefits are very big, people are just inclined to think more and more and more about them. But I'm telling you now, like when you play against the Rakdos Sactic, if you see they have the Obosh, you know there's no Priest. If you see they have the Luris, you know there's no Mayhem Devil. That gives you a lot of valuable information about how to play against them. It's not nothing.
Of course, but in general, when we're playing matches of Magic, a lot of that information comes out. You might have it a little bit sooner by seeing the Obosh or whatever. It's like, you know, when you're playing Commander, you see your opponent's Commander and you're like, okay, cool, I know what you're, you know, about in this game. And so you can have an idea of the strategy you want to get into. And like, that can change the hands you keep. I get that entirely. But in terms of, like, how games play out, when you see someone open with a certain temple, you kind of know your options of what they're playing anyway. Your brain immediately narrows it down. Then the next land comes out, or they play an Arboreal Grazer, or they play whatever it is. And you're like, cool, I know what you're playing now. That takes 1 or 2 turns. So I do get the advantage of having that information before you mulligan is definitely good. Like, that is something that can be helpful. So if you see someone has a Luris before you need to mulligan, you can go, cool, I can get exactly what I need to play against this person now. So I do see the advantage there for you as the player not playing it. You're not giving away that information. But typically, you're going to know what your opponent's playing by turn 2 or 3.
So that's just one part of it, right? There's the information before the mulligan. There's also like, so the Karuga Fires deck cannot play Aethergust. I don't have to play around Aethergust against them because they have Karuga in their deck, right? It's not just for the mulligan. There's various points in the game where those constraints make a difference to how you play.
Okay, I get you there. Like, it does impact how everyone plays the game, essentially. It's not just
I don't disagree with you at all, Anthony. I don't disagree with anything that you're saying. Those are all valid points. I don't think the value of an extra card and an extra powerful card, you know, whatever that effect is, if that it's built around a deck, can be underestimated. And so, yeah, as I said, maybe standard, it's fine. Maybe it'll prove to be perfectly reasonable in standard, and I wouldn't be surprised. But in those older formats, what are you sacrificing in Burn in Modern? You know, what are you sacrificing in Storm in Legacy? You know, there's those examples where you don't have to warp your deck at all. It's already there. You're adding this power piece into it.
The reason I'm inclined to talk about standard is just because I personally think that Wizards don't care. I think in their mind, if they have to ban a card in certain formats, but it's good in others, that's still a success. I mean, we see that with the printing of Litry, right? It got immediately banned in Commander, even as they printed it. So, yeah. And I actually read a discussion on Twitter with some of the WotC staff, and they were saying that literally what I was saying now, that they sort of think if they print new cards and they're very valuable contribution to some formats but not others, that's more than enough for them. So my sense is sort of like there's a very reasonable chance that a lot, if not all of them, at least half of the companions are going to be banned in older formats quite soon. But so for me, it's almost like a moot point. I just don't really care because they're going to be for a while. They're going to be gone. Whereas in standard, it's much more interesting. You know, it's like they're probably going to be around for a while. And there's sort of interesting thought experiments around. For example, I've been thinking about before this set, one of the worst matchups for Mono Red was Jeskai Fires. Now that Jeskai Fires plays Karuga, I'm not so sure it's a bad matchup for Red, because if you don't have a Clarion, you're really bad at interacting with them. Like, you can't side in your Gust, you can't mainboard your Gust, you don't have Devout Decrees. So those questions are very interesting standard, and I agree with you, Karan. They're not
very
interesting
in
older formats, because in older formats, the restrictions just don't matter much.
The one thing is, you don't have to play the Companion in the second game. You can have Aether Gust in your sideboard. You can have all those cards in your sideboard and just leave Karuga out. So game two, you can have Devout Decree. You can have Aether Gust. You can do all those things. And so game two and three, you can just go back to playing the old deck. And I think that's, you know, something that's going to come up pretty soon. Like,
I mean, you're right, that's an adaptation that's possible. But I have to say, looking at the list so far, people aren't doing that yet. So it might take development for that to happen.
Yeah, I think we're still very, like I say, we're in very early days with this mechanic. Like, there's a lot of room to build, there's a lot of room to grow. I mean, I was saying on the last podcast that Urion, you know, is complete, like, no, there's no point in building around Urion, and now there's decent decks with Urion that I want to play. So I think there's a lot of room with what they've done here. And that's cool. That's exciting to me. Like, I'm happy to build around it. I'm happy to try these different things. But at the same time, I do just, you know, worry about the fundamentals of the game that, like, I enjoy playing and what I enjoy about it. And as it carries on, that might change. And I might not enjoy certain things as much. And something like Companion might influence that. It doesn't at the moment. I'm using it. I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying the back and forth with it. But in a month's time, are we still going to be going back and forth, you know? So we'll see how it all plays out.
My personal guess, I saw there was a tweet by Seth Manfield sometime last week asking how long it's going to take before every deck has a companion in it. And I certainly answered that poll with, that's never going to happen. Like, that's my expectation, is there will always be decks in standard that don't use companion. And I think Temur Reclamation right now is like the go-to obvious one. Like, there's just no way for that deck to use a companion, and it's still a very good deck.
Yeah.
And I think also we're due to see Mono Red make a resurgence, because it always does in every format, right? And that's also, there's no real companion suited to that. And that's also going to, you know, rebalance where the meta's at. I do just want to say, like, Karan, I know you've been trying to add it a few times, just to be absolutely clear. I think we all agree here that they're like a total fuck show when it comes to old formats. Like, it's...
Mm. Yeah. That's cool. 100% agreed.
Can I tell you my biggest gripe with Companion? It's not the 8 cards necessarily, although that's a little annoying, but it's the fact that you're guaranteed to see that card in the game.
Yep.
That's my biggest gripe with it, is that, because, you know, the whole thing about Magic is there's variance involved. You might have a deck built around a certain card or payoff or whatever, but there's no guarantee that you see that card in a game. And while that might sound unintuitive, that's what Magic is. It's, you know, let's hope things come together. Let's hope I draw things in the right order, etc. And that's my biggest gripe with Companion. But anyway, we'll leave it there. I think it's time for some Limited, hey?
Yeah, sure.
Let's get into Limited talk, since I think that's the thing everyone's been... Well, everyone on this podcast, at least, and a lot of people listening have probably been enjoying quite a bit of. Since, Arena now has in-person drafts, or 8-person drafts that you can do for real. I know, Karan, you don't care about that too much. You've probably been getting major ticks over there on MTGO. How's it been going for you there?
So funny enough, the majority of my play, draft has been on Arena.
You're trying to build a collection.
So I've been chatting with Cal, former national champion Kalyan Petkov, and so we've been hanging out because he's also been sort of unemployed at this during this whole Corona period. And he told me to play Arena because they gave you a free draft.
Yeah.
And so I played the free draft, and now I'm like Arena rich, which is quite funny. That's been cool. Playing a bit of Arena and having to play against people. I will say that like my general experience with Arena and Limited, and maybe it's because they gave out the free drafts, is that standard of play is terrible. And like it's so noticeable when I switch between if I'm just messing around in a draft and I jump onto MTGO, the level of play is just so different. So that I find a bit weird. But yeah, it's been fun, and it's nice that it's finally here, and it's an option, and you're able to draft. It's a little weird that they don't have best of the normal draft. Best of three, four, rank.
Yeah, that's the problem, is they've got it, but it's not for ranked. And they gave their reasoning on it, but yeah, it sucks that they're doing that you have to just play best of one if you want to play ranked.
So I mean, whatever. Like as you said, and maybe we need to. We were having this chat the other day in a group around another issue, and Anthony was telling me about looking at Arena as a different sort of game, and maybe that's it.
Oh,
maybe
yes.
You need to look at it as a different game and be fine with having these things, these best of ones and so forth, if that's what appeals to a larger player base,
Yeah. Okay, carry on, Anthony.
Well, I just wanted to say, Karan, I sort of think, as someone who's drafted a lot and is still drafting a lot in Arena, my sense is that the highest level of player drafting on Arena is pretty much the same as the highest level player on MTGO. The difference is that there's a huge number of lower level players who are also playing on Arena, and that's so the only real difference is that Magic Online doesn't attract new players, whereas Arena does, and so you've. And especially right now, I don't know if you guys know to confirm this, but I've read a few people on Twitter saying that right now, since they released the sets, the matchmaking isn't by rank at the moment in the Premier Draft.
No, they intentionally changed that because people complained about their EV essentially. For a long time, they were saying you would get matched up by someone else, whether you were 0-1 and they were 2-0. Like, because you were both on a similar rank, you would get ranked against each other. So now, apparently, if I've read this correctly, I might be wrong, the way they're ranking it is based on your record, not on your rank. So if you're both 3-1, then you're going to be playing against each other because your decks are 3-1 decks, essentially. I think that's the way it's working at the moment.
Because my understanding was the only reason that they didn't have best of three ranked is because they wanted to separate those two things. They wanted the best of threes to rank according to record, and the ranked ones to rank according to rank. But experientially, I can tell you that in this format, it feels like we're not being ranked according to rank. I can tell you on my path to Mythic from Platinum, I almost exclusively played against Bronze and Silver players. And even since I've been Mythic, I regularly play against Silver and Gold players. It's like a very, very strange experience.
Yeah, I'm in Gold, and I've been playing against Mythics and stuff like that. But I'm not too stressed about it. I feel like it's kind of like, drafting at an FNM. You're going to have some players who are really good and you're going to have some who are really bad, and you just got to navigate the table and, the draft itself, because some of the drafts I've had have just been silly and others have been really okay, what actually happened here?
The frustrating thing is actually what it does to the pods, the drafting stage, not necessarily the pairing stage. For example, the best deck in the format right now is Cycling. And I think people who get Cycling decks, their decks are usually better than they should be. And I guess people playing on Magic Online are probably experiencing less overpowered Cycling decks. Because I've had so many drafts where I know I'm the only person in it. No one's picking one mana Cyclers. No one's picking the Cycling payoffs. I've got a fifth or sixth pick Zenith Flare, even though it's a mythic uncommon.
Wow.
The Cycling cards are being underdrafted, and at the same time, I feel like the Mutate cards are being overdrafted, and so probably in reality, the Cycling deck's a bit worse than what we think it is, and the Mutate cards are a bit better than what we think they are, but there's this weird distorted effect where the weaker players seem to overvalue the mutation and undervalue the cycling.
That I think is fairly fair from my experiences as well. When I saw the cycling deck being spoken about on Twitter as one of the better decks, because I started out just going with the red-blue stuff mostly and just doing the draw cards, make 8-8s, various, you know, different payoffs that they have for the red-blue deck. I was enjoying that a lot for most of the while, and then trying to just play five-color decks or just multicolor decks where I could. And then I heard about this red-white, and I tried it, and it's just open constantly. Like, every draft, if I want to do it, I can do it. And that shouldn't be possible, I don't think.
I mean, it's very stupid. I saw a tweet by someone saying that Zenith player shouldn't be able to target face. I think that would be a very good fix. Probably the reason Zenith player yeah. can target face... Probably the reason you can target a player with Zenith player is because they wanted it to be playable in standard. That's probably why they did that, because it didn't need to have that to be good enough. It would have already been good enough for Limited just to kill creatures. Because it kills players, it gives the cycling decks... You play like 13 lands in your deck, and you play a ton of one-mana cyclers, and even if you're not finding your payoffs, eventually you suddenly just drain them for 10. You know, like it's... I had a game last night where I was playing like a Sultai deck I drafted against a cycling player, and I had complete control of the board. I had 3 massive permanents. They had nothing. They flare me for lethal. I have the counter spell. I counted it. And next turn, they flare me again for lethal. And I'm like, what? Like, you've just dealt me 2 times. You've just targeted me for 10 damage with 4 mana spells.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. It's pretty wild. I mean, it's interesting that you say that. I think... exactly that. The flare is just the power levels through the roof. But like, I've had multiple cycling decks where I've had no flare, and just the combination of stingers and the tapper and maybe Marmoset.
The tapper is wonderful.
Yeah, you just run your opponent over. It doesn't matter what they're doing. Like, I mean, and maybe the point that you made around weaker players sort of being attracted by flashy mutate. And maybe because Arena has more of those, you tend to, they don't value cycling, and that's why it's so easy to do. But man, it just seems so easy to put together, like just with the commons. Sufficient one mana cyclers as well. There's so many. And so, I don't know, man. The draft format, and again, because majority of my drafting has been on Arena, maybe that changes it. But I think the cycling deck is just overpowered. And it's just, it feels dumb, you know, if I'm the person playing cycling or my opponent's the one doing it, I feel like whoever's on cycling is probably going to win any given match.
But that also means that that's going to become the most drafted deck, and then people are going to compete for it, and it's going to weaken the power level of the general deck as time goes on, right?
So I think it's the best deck even without the flair, but I don't think it's broken without the flair. And I think that if people are competing for the deck, you will usually not get a copy of Flare even when you're playing cycling. The reason that you're always getting it is because you're the only one in your pod drafting it a lot of the time, which shouldn't be happening.
Yeah.
And even when you are the only one drafting the archetype, you shouldn't be getting one mana cyclers wheeling. And that's my real issue so far is that players don't value the one mana cyclers properly. Like any person should be one. Any person who's playing blue in their deck should highly value the 5-mana blue spell that has 1-mana cycling.
Like it finishes games or draws your card.
So, like, usually when you draft cycling, you have no one else drafting it. And secondly, like, the really big kicker is that those random 1-mana cyclists just come to you. They just get handed to you, which I think once the format's established, and certainly in, like, a human pod in real life, that's not going to be happening. In a competitive draft, you're not just going to get like 100 one-mana cyclers without having to work for them. One counterpoint to what I'm saying right now is that I do feel like the power level of like the average common is higher than usual. Like my experience has been that even the bad players I play against still can do powerful things in their decks, almost like accidentally, just because I haven't come across any draft decks in this format which have zero capacity to do any powerful thing. There's just like so many simple, powerful combinations you can put together. You know, there's like that flying cow, which you can divine arrow or rock slide, and suddenly you've just like one-shot people. There's the bushmeat poacher, which you can combo with the beetle thing. There's like all these, there's the parcel beast that goes with the glimmer bell. There's all these like insane, very easy to put together combinations. And so I feel like every deck has quite powerful things. What puts the cycling deck ahead of all of them is that it's just insanely consistent because of the nature of cycling. So it always draws the cards it has to draw. It always has the payoffs. It, you know, like...
But, I think the cycles are obviously in each color as well, so that's something that people just need to, in general, be looking at more for their decks. But like you were saying, the wheeling the one-mana cyclers, that's something, I mean, when I first started the drafting, I wasn't, like, that high on, you know, that Dino, the 3-6 Vigilance Dino. And then eventually, like, wait, this can, like, early it's going to either just, you know, help me with my mana, or it's going to be a payoff for one of the... That's, you know, Dino, the, what's that dinosaur enchantment called? The 5-4 Trampler?
Reptilian
something. Yeah.
Yeah. So you got that. You've got, you know, the pinger. You've got all of that. So whatever, just discard this card, draw another card, deal the damage, have a 5-4 Dino, have your 2-3 first striker get +2/+0 and attack. Like, that's crazy. Or you can have it just play it in the late game, mutate something else onto it, and you've got a big Vigilance guy. So it's weird how just having to analyze cards differently now, because typically a 3-6 Vigilance for 6 mana, that's not something you're going to be that interested in at all. And now you're saying that's a card that shouldn't wheel. And I agree with you 100%.
I mean, one of the upshots of the current situation is the good cycling decks, they just play less lands. Like, the most they play is 15. Sometimes I've played as few as 12 lands in a cycling deck.
What?
Now, that also means that I've gotten 7 wins with a 12 land cycling deck. Now, that also means that one of the ways that, like, variance screws you normally in Magic doesn't count for you, because you can't get flooded. You know, like, it's impossible for you to get flooded. Your deck is just gas. Like, it's just ridiculous. But the reason you get away with playing 12 lands is because, firstly, you have nothing expensive to do in your deck, except things that have cycling themselves. And secondly, you've got like 10 copies of one mana cyclers and 10 copies of two mana cyclers. And so as long as you establish your first two lands, you will always be able to play a game of Magic. And you don't need more than 12 lands to actually do that.
And your opponent's sitting there with Karuga as their companion. I think you're going to have a pretty good time when that happens.
That's, can I want to say that...
Yes, Karen.
Sorry.
Karen. No, Karen, Karen. We'll get into it.
I just wanted to add that, like, despite the fact that I'm sort of complaining that, I think partly because of the design, but also partly because people are drafting wrong, that there are some things that are very powerful. The real reason I really love this format is because I think it's got an extremely high skill ceiling. It's very, very difficult to play optimally. Like, I feel like you have so many more decision points than usual. And one of the reasons is, I think Ben Stark put it this way, that mutate cards and cycling cards are basically both a kind of split card. So
exactly.
So many of the cards in your deck can go one way or another. Even inside the bastard cycling decks, you get decisions every turn about which card to cycle. Which one am I more likely to want to play as a card? When do I play my Drowner Stinger? Like, personally, I kind of always play it on turn two if I have a turn two. But, you know, sometimes you draw it later and then it's like, well, do you want the creature for the ping? Do you want to just draw another card to get close to your flare? I feel like there's so many huge decisions. And I will say that the vast majority of games that I lose in this format, I look at it afterwards and I'm like, there was a decision in that game. If I had made slightly differently, I might have won. And personally, I love that. That's, you know, I don't know if any of you guys played Artifact when it was alive for a while last year, but I felt like Artifact was that kind of game. And it was exactly why I liked it, because it has the kind of complexity where there's always something you could have done slightly better to win. And so you're learning every single time you lose. And that is really what gets me going in Magic.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I've found quite a few matches to be like that. Like, the ones that I lose, I'm like, I should have just played that as a creature, not mutated it onto there. You know, like, there's lots of things where you're like, you sit and you think and you weigh up the options and you go, okay, I think this is the correct line. And then it's not the correct line and you lose and you're like, okay, like, next time. But then next time the situation's different and you've still got to, like, come at it with everything you've learned so far, but still analyze the situation at hand, because I'm finding there are a lot of unique scenarios coming up when it comes to the set because of mutate. You know, creatures have different kinds of abilities and different triggers happening when it mutates. And Yeah, there's a lot of diversity within the format, and I've been enjoying that a hell of a lot. I think, like you say, there is a high skill level, and not just in, like we say, the red-white cycling deck is pretty easy to get, and it is, but there are other decks in the format, and there's your color pairs in general are still pretty good. Most people are seeing, I think, are going into three colors. That's a lot of what I'm seeing is, you know, people starting with their two colors and then still splashing whatever they open in pack two or three. And yeah, what else have you guys been seeing in terms of decks? Because we're speaking a bit about the Saltar Mutate, and we've spoken a little bit about the red white cycling. But what else have you been seeing on ladder?
Can I just one last thing on cycling, and to show you how absurd the cycling deck was. I was in a draft the other day, and I was firmly red white cycling. I had no flares, but I had, you know, all the other stuff. I had multiple stingers, the tapper, the marmoset, and then tons of one mana cyclers. And it's pack three, pick two, and I get past a brood moth. And in the pack, there's a brood moth and there's a stinger. And I'm like, okay, stinger it is. And I just pass the brood moth. And like, that's how, like, I think warped the cycling deck is. Is like the one of the best mythic bombs in the set in your colors.
Yes, I need it.
And you just like, nope, it's rubbish. Four mana, I'm not going to use it. I'd rather kill them, focus on my plan. And like, at that moment, I realized, well, yeah, the cycling deck is a problem. It's dumb. And it when you're making decisions like that, then something's wrong with this archetype in the draft format. I do think that the drafting, not drafting and playing in your pod is part of the problem as well. I think that would have a major impact, because if you're in your pod, you're incentivized to hate and, you know, cut pieces here or there, where, you know, even when I'm drafting, I typically, if it's a, you know, on these formats, I'm like, well, I'm not going to play against these people, so I'm not going to hate. Let them get the best deck that they possibly can, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
So cooperate, if you will. So yeah, that's my last bit on cycling.
Okay, but are there any other decks that you've been trying to play at the moment? I mean, like, humans is obviously one of the options that's out there. Mutates, there's blue-white flyers. So yeah, what are you guys trying other than red-white cycling?
It's hard to get a good humans deck, but when you get the good deck, it's one of the best decks, actually, because other than the cycling deck, most people are very slow in this format. So
yeah,
I found that if you manage to put together a good deck that curves out with a powerful 2-drop into powerful 3-drop into powerful 4-drop, you get tons of free wins in this format. It's just very hard to do that. Like, there's actually not a lot of good ways you can build a curving out deck. So you have to kind of see the rights, especially uncommons, like that 2-mana 2-3 that makes your legendaries indestructible and creates 1/1s, and that kind of stuff is really good, but it's at uncommon. Another uncommon that I think is insane is the black-green one, Back for More. I think that card's totally busted.
Oy.
It's like, it's better than most of the rares, I think. And I first pick it very often and then move into the black-green archetype because, I mean, part of why
it's busted. Yeah, Back for More and Boneyard Lurker.
Well, so that's the thing. A big part of why it's busted is you have all these really huge creatures that have cycling. And so you can basically always set up that you've got something huge in your graveyard and then it's instant speed. So you can like reanimate something, fight something, block something else. And then you've just like, you've got
complete
a huge
blowout
creature and you've killed two of their creatures. It's ridiculous. So that's another archetype that's, I mean, I feel like the black green kind of deck is as good as it's Black for More is a bit like Zenith Flare in the sense that like, it's a totally different tier of deck when you have the card and when you don't have the card.
Agreed.
And another deck that surprised me in actually being quite good is Vigilance, which it's hilarious because almost every Magic format has had like these throwaway Vigilance cards that are usually unplayable. And in this format, we've been given payoffs that make them into a deck if you get the payoffs. I still feel like I probably won't go for the deck unless I start with the rare.
Which are the payoffs you're talking about, Jim? Because I know about like Alert Heatbounder and stuff like that, but which is the rare?
So the rare is the 4-mana 3/5 that all your Vigilance creatures can tap things down. Pay one, tap a creature.
Yes, opposition.
It has Vigilance as well. Yeah. So there's that at rare. Then at uncommon, there's the Mentor, which gives something Vigilance and buffs all your Vigilance creatures. Also not very popularly picked, so quite easy to get. And then there's actually a common payoff, which is the Aura. That's 1-mana flash. gives something +1/+1, and if it has vigilance, it fights based on its toughness. It's really weird to me because it was something that I thought wouldn't work out, and I went 7 wins with the deck just because I started with that 3/5, and then I was like, well, why don't I just see where this goes? And you end up with all these like 2-mana 1/4 vigilance and 3-mana 2/4 vigilance, which are cards that you usually wouldn't want in your deck at all. But the payoffs are really actually very significant, and it's actually a playable deck that, like, if that's the draft spot you're in, you can go for.
Okay, cool. Karan, what have you been finding success with?
Well, success whenever I play red-white cycling. But apart from that, my favorite deck is like blue-red. And there's a number of ways. Yeah, like tempo-based blue-red. And there's a number of ways you can go about it. And there's the Coastal Piracy reprint. you know, the enchantment, whenever a creature you control deals damage, draw a card.
You draw a card. And it's
Yes. So, you know, there's some really cool things you can do with that, with you know, nice cheap evasion guys like the Bell, the 2-drop Bell guy.
Have you decked yourself yet?
I won with 0 cards in my deck.
I've done that too. Yes.
Yeah. So that was quite nice, but I haven't decked myself in the format. I think, well, if you're decking yourself in the format, you're probably not managing your game very well, generally speaking.
I haven't decked myself either, but like I got that 0 cards in the deck win, and I can only imagine how salty my opponent must have been. But yeah, you plan things out with this deck. That's what I like about it.
Yeah, but my favorite part of the blue-red deck interaction is to draft the Maker 1/1 Dinosaur and Human. And then
draw 2 cards.
Yeah, it's to draw 2 cards, but also using the Dinosaur to mutate is fantastic. So whether it's Cloud Piercer, Heron, the hero parrot, Porky Parrot. Yeah, and so you can come out really aggressive aggressive in that regard. And then because you typically are quite spells focused, the 4-mana 2/3 trample, get a counter whenever you play a non-creature spell, that thing just goes off, and it's a win con on its own. So I really enjoy the blue-red deck, but I think you do rely on some premium pieces, because you're fighting for a lot of the premium removal and
like Fire Prophecy and stuff like that as well. Like you're battling the other good deck in the format for like a lot of the good red cards.
Yeah, but I love the deck. I think it's great, and it's just a fun tempo deck to put together.
Yeah, that's also been my favorite deck to play. Like I said in the beginning, I've forced it a bit too many times, but it's honestly been like a lot of fun for me. I've been enjoying playing with the various sharks, but the Heron is one of my favorite cards in the set at the moment. Just that 4-mana, draw a card, swing for 3, like you say, on the dinos, or if you're playing the Sultai deck, you know, you might have put it on the Farfinder or something like that. You know, there's so many different options to just suddenly be flying in for 3 on turn 4 and having drawn a card. So that I think might be one of my favorite cards in the set, just in general to play.
And the nice thing is with that deck, you can set up those mid game turns where you holding back the make 2 guys plus a mutate creature. And so you look for that spot, you play your 2 guys. Obviously, the one has haste. You mutate and you finish the game, which also comes up, I think, a fair amount of time. So that's quite a cool thing. And then there's like a variation of the blue-red deck is more of a Jeskai deck, which is also pretty easy to put together. But then you often have a cycling theme and in that. Yeah, and you know, the things like Jeskai Ultimatum, the Jeskai Enchantment, whenever you draw cards for non-creatures, and those typically you can pick them up quite late, so and build them around. So also pretty cool decks that I've enjoyed.
Is that actually something you guys have been finding, that a lot of the 3-color cards are coming to you fairly late?
I mean, I think what's happening in this format is that a lot of the time people start with bombs, and I think probably correctly actually people are sort of loyal to their bombs, and I think that's probably right in this format when you start with a very big bomb to like stick towards its colors. And what that means is that often you just can't, you know, you see a 3-color card, and even though it's really strong, you're not in those colors, you're in like the other 2 colors, or you're in only one of those colors. But that's actually, I wanted to ask you guys in general about how you feel about A, the ultimatums, and B, I think we should talk about companions, even though we talked about them at the start. We never really talked about them specifically in how you build your draft deck. Because I was on Twitter a lot, and there were certain people like Matt Sterling and I think Ari Lax at the start of the format who were saying, if you get a companion, you must sacrifice everything to make a deck that fulfills its condition. And
yeah, but it's not like those guys don't have controversial opinions just for fun. So
sure. And, I mean, look, they're very good players and very good drafters. And obviously they were posting results and winning by doing that all the time. But my experience is that the more I've drafted, the more I've felt like that's not really true. I think companions are one of the strongest things you can do. And we're talking about archetypes. One archetype in this format is just get a companion and build a deck for it. That is an archetype.
Yeah.
But I think they're subject to context like everything else in Magic. And so I think that every time I've had an early companion and then like forced myself strictly to draft according to its condition, I've always regretted it. And I've ended up feeling like what you should be doing is drafting what's in front of you the way you should always draft, what they call drafting the hard way. And like,
yeah, exactly.
Sure, you have a companion, stay open to the possibility that you'll have a deck where it is your companion, but don't like, just because you got an early Obosh, now you see like a busted 4-mana card and you're just not going to pick it. If it's the best card for you to pick, like you should still be picking it.
Because you can still put the companions in your deck.
Exactly, and a lot of them are actually perfectly good cards, just as regular cards. Most of them are. But there are some really cool companion-based decks. I got to tell you guys, I got absolutely beaten down by, what's the red-white companion called? I think it's called Zerda.
That's right.
Yes.
So my opponent who had that as their companion, and the way they beat me was with, they had a million of those little one-mana green creatures, the Brushwags.
And they just pumped it. Nice.
And like, obviously, I'm never going to kill their Brushwags, and they just waited and waited, and once I'd used all my removal, they played their companion, and suddenly they can pay 2 to give +3/+3 to their creatures. And like, that was actually impossible to deal with. That was just like, it's way too efficient, the pump, when you have the Zerda arts. And I thought that was very creative. I thought like a creative way to like make use of that particular companion.
Yeah, that is. I just think like if you get Lutri like in pack one, pick one, like just go for it. Like that is the one like that I haven't had the opportunity yet. But I feel like that deck's pretty easy to put together anyway. You're not making that many concessions. So yeah, like in a limited thing.
There's a few, right? Like I think Lutri is fairly easy to put together. Giganta, Gyaruda is a bit more of you can't play odd mana costs, but the effect is so powerful. And if you're guaranteeing me that I can play the 6/6 and get a free threat every game, I'm gonna build my deck around it. Unfortunately, I haven't had that one in draft, but I've had it in sealed, and it was just beyond ridiculous.
So what I found about Garuda is that when you're playing a blue deck with Garuda, it's quite easy to meet the condition. When you're playing a black deck with Garuda, a lot of the time the other finishes in your deck are all odd, because all of those big cycling creatures are odd. You know, the worm is odd, the big green dinosaur is odd, the big like a lot of the cards you actually want as win cons, you just can't play with that. So I basically what I found is in like the black green deck, I usually play it as just a normal card, but in like let's say a blue red deck, then I would play it as a companion.
It seems fair. Yeah, but I actually haven't thought about that. But yeah, as I said, I have never got it in draft, so I wasn't able to even come up with that. But yeah, I the companions are ridiculous. I think they're ridiculous and in limited, and it's frustrating. It's hella frustrating when a guy reveals a decent one, whether it's Garuda, the what's the one, the 5/4 that draws cards,
Karuga.
Oh my god,
the dinosaur
someone reveals that. Okay, yeah, there's a cost, and I guess it's less of an issue in draft. Oh, but it's still
If I'm playing the red white cycling deck, I don't mind if I see a Karuga.
Yeah, of course. Well, if you're playing the red white cycling deck, you don't care what your opponent's doing generally. Like, so that's kind of irrelevant. But like any other matchup, the companions are just broken and limited. And the first few times that it happened, the way opponents casted against me, or I casted, I just thought, wow, this is not fair. This is really not fair. We shouldn't be allowed to have this cast this powerful card every game. It's just not right. That was kind of my reaction.
I haven't come up against it, so I haven't like that much. So like I can't really comment, to be honest.
The card I feel most like that about in this format is not even a companion. It's the Mardu Ultimatum. Every single time I cast it, I feel like a bad person because you always win the game on the spot, and often it's in a situation where like you were way behind. Your deck is probably a lot worse than your opponent's. You really have no right to win the game, but you just play this one card and like that's it.
The Genesis Ultimatum is also game over.
Yeah, but you have to work, right? Like, you have to work for those cards. They cost 7 mana, and the mana requirement's quite specific, and you have to stay alive, and there's a lot of things that need to go right to make that work. Where,
of course.
If it's Karuga, then you just, don't play 1 and 2 drops. Okay, it's not that difficult. It's really not difficult to make the
work. If you're on the draw and your opponent curves out, it's quite hard, eh? Like, that's... Like, sure. Luckily in this format, that's a very rare thing to happen because most people have two decks. But there are some decks that Karuga decks just can't beat.
That's a fair point. That's the concession that you make, right? Like, you get in that particular example, you get this exceptionally powerful, card, but you run the risk of being run over. But, equally, you can... draft, if it's a draft context and you pick it up early enough, you can draft your deck around really defensive, rubbish big bodies to sort of help you get to that late game. I think so. I don't know. Companion's definitely more broken and limited than it is in standard. I will say that.
I could probably agree with that, but like I say, I haven't played against companions much and I haven't had one as a companion yet. I tried with Karuga, but it didn't work.
I think they are very powerful. I just think they're not powerful enough to be thought of as separate from the normal idea of drafting the hard way. Like, they're still context sensitive.
Stay open.
And with some of them especially, like, I mean, Karan, what do you think of Yorion? Like, have you ever felt good about running Yorion as your companion in a draft?
No, I think it's stupid to do it in draft. I think it's just wrong. I can't picture a scenario where it's right to do it in draft. In sealed, absolutely, it's possible when your pool is terrible and you kind of can patch together a deck with multiple colors. So funny enough, the other night I was playing a prelim, and I played Yorion as my companion. I played it as my companion, and it was just so funny. Like, you have this 60 card deck, and you just sort of at the mercy of am I drawing removal? Am I going to draw my removal? What's my chance of drawing my whatever, my good four drop? It felt terrible. It felt terrible. I won a cup. I think I went 3-2 or I might have went 3-2 in that particular prelim. But yeah, Yorion felt terrible. I don't think it's a good one to have as your companion. But Karuga, Giganta, a bunch of them are fantastic, I think, and can be really powerful. Lutri, etc. So, I had a funny screenshot. I don't know if you guys saw it. I posted it on Twitter the other day where it was like, I'm playing against Willy Edel, and we both, the beginning of the game, Magic Online, it just pops up with a little notification. And like, he reveals, I think he revealed Karuga, and I think I revealed Yorion, and it was just so funny, in a game of limited, and we both have these companions. Magic's changing, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. And one of the things with this companion thing, like Anthony did bring up earlier, just something people need to remember is you don't, like, you can pick the card early and see what comes along with it, but you can just play it in your main deck. You don't have to play it as a companion. A lot of these cards, even something like Giganta, the Wellspring, that's not a bad card on its own. Like, it's a perfectly fine magic card if your deck doesn't come together. And that is obviously one of the harder ones to come together. But even Kahira, that's just a decent card on its own and can give a few other creatures in your deck a buff. And so then you don't necessarily need to make the whole deck cats, elemental, nightmare, dinosaurs, or beasts. Some of them can be there, and it's just an extra lord that you have in your main deck. So that's something people just need to consider, I think, drafting.
So Kahira in particular, I felt like was, after Yorion, it's probably the second biggest trap to to actually play as your companion. Because, you know, there was a draft, I got an early Kahir, and then I tried to build my deck around it. And I ended up feeling like, because of the way the cards, like, what you end up picking is those bad, like, 2-mana 1/4 Vigilance Cats. And, like, you end up picking sort of weak creatures because they're the right creature type. And it's only good if you have Kahir on the board and they're Anthemed and Vigilance. But your opponent so easily kills Kahir, and then you're, like, left with this bad bunch of creatures in your deck. So I felt like after that draft that it just made more sense to usually think of playing that card as a creature and only under sort of exceptional circumstances. I mean, like, you'd play it as a companion in, like, I don't know, maybe a certain blue cycling green decks or like certain,
or the blue green deck, because that's got a lot of beasts in it. Like that blue green like mutate deck. Like,
sure. But I don't think you want to pick that card first and then just pick lots of creatures that are the right type and try and like have a sort of aggressive deck based on this one Anthem that hopefully never gets killed. Like, that doesn't work. That's
100%.
The one interesting one is the Omori, the one that you, like, choose a card type.
The top,
I've found that card just is very good as a normal card. I played it once as my companion and did well, but I think it is risky as a companion because you basically can't play removal, and then if your opponent just, like, has a powerful thing, you lose.
Well, you could mutate creatures that you could use as removal, but that's about it.
Yeah. I mean, there's some workarounds. There's also, like, that Kogla, the big ape that can fight things, but, like...
Yeah.
Which, by the way, that card is nuts. That card's one of my favorite bombs in the set.
Same. I've had one deck with it, and it's, yeah, every time it came into play, it did the things, and then I won.
There's some really weird interactions in this format as well that you, like, have to learn as you go. I don't know if you guys have come across, like, the fact that you can mutate creatures you own, not creatures you control. So if you steal your opponent's creature, you can't mutate onto it.
Okay.
At the same time, weirdly enough, you can mutate onto their stuff if they steal it from you. I mean, it just came up for me when I played a Garuda, and then I took a creature from their graveyard, and I wanted to mutate onto it, and the game wouldn't let me. And actually, the only reason I took that creature is because it had, like, a mutate trigger. So that's, I guess, there's some reason for why they decided to make it own and not control. I don't know what it is.
But... So wait, like, so if your opponent has to steal one of your creatures, and it's a big creature... Could you just then, it would have to be a flash mutate thing, but if they keep control of it, can you just put another creature on top of that and make it smaller?
Yeah. It's just what? Something you own. It's, I mean, it's like, it's sort of niche, but it does come up, right?
That's crazy. And I can't wait to try to do it. Like, whenever it happens, like, I just want to find this niche situation where it's like, next leveling my opponents just by mutating a creature that they've stolen from me. That's going to be fun to do if I get to. I just want to do that once in this entire format. I think you just put me onto my one goal for the year. Thank you, Anthony.
you're welcome. I mean, but that's part of what's cool in this format. There's so many cool little interactions. Mm-hmm. Personally, my favorite one is with the Kyle, I can never remember the name of the card. You know what I'm talking about? The 3-mana 1/3 flying. And you just.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a bunch of things you can do. Like, using Divine Arrow is quite cute, but the really cool one is the Rock Slide that deals one for each land you have. And you just, like, 4-mana deal, like, 8 to it. Suddenly it's a 9-12 and you attack for lethal. Like, that kind of thing is just absurd.
Mm.
Which is, I mean, it's a funny part of that card as well, because I sort of feel like that card, that creature, is not very good if you don't have ways to burn it. But, like, when you can burn it, it can be like one of the best cards in your deck.
So if you get it early, then you can draft towards it.
Yeah, which is, I mean, to me, the overarching theme of drafting in the set is whether it's a mechanic like cycling or mutate or companion or like a gimmick, you kind of need to have like a narrative for your deck, like a game plan that you're building towards, or if it's like
yes
for more, like the reanimate decks. But there's so many of them. There's like 20 different narratives a deck could have, but you just need to choose one and then build that. That's like sort of the unifying theme of the set for me.
Okay. And when, like, are you, because you're talking about drafting the hard way, when do you start deciding, you know, what deck you're in, like around what pick? Because I'm finding, you know, I stay open until about pack well, pick 5 or 6 is when I'm starting to figure out where I'm really at. So how are you finding it?
I mean, for me personally, if I have a bomb, usually I try very hard to stick to the bomb. If I'm in cycling, I'm just going to stick in cycling, and you know very early. If you don't have a bomb and you're not in cycling, then I think you might as well stay open for a while, as you said, like to like sort of the middle of pack one or something like that. And this format has a very, very high number of playables. And especially if you include just like random off-color cyclers as playables, which I think I usually do.
Especially if you can reanimate them.
Yeah, so you can actually afford to stay open quite a while, because almost every deck you're going to end up having more cards that are playable than what you actually put in your deck. So there is some sort of slack given to you in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing I've found, essentially what you're saying there. Like, if the decks I really like aren't open, like the red, blue, and the red, white, like, aren't immediately there, or I don't open a bomb, I am just trying to stay as open as possible for as long as possible, because there's a lot of cool multicolored potential decks. There's a lot of fixing. There's a lot of power in general in the set. And there's a lot of things, like you say, like you can just play off-color cyclers in the, like in the black green deck, especially you can play like some of the red cyclers and bring back, you know, like a 5/5 hasty boy. And like, that's pretty fun to do when you're playing no red mana.
Last time I discovered there's actually a cool Gruul deck you can draft in a set where you like play a very large number of expensive creatures, like all the 7 mana cycling creature, the 6 mana cycling creature, the 9 mana cycling creature, and you have all these massive end of your curve cards, but because they all have cycling, you still end up playing like 15 lands in your deck. The only hard thing about that deck is that there's a lack of options at the sort of 2-drop slot early on. So one of the interesting things I noted is that the Drannith Stinger is actually a card that is needed by lots of decks. It's not just the cycling deck. Like, any sort of red base aggro deck wants to have
that. Yeah, red blue takes it.
Because there aren't really other 2-drops for you to play. So that's another thing that sort of made me a bit annoyed, that when I draft cycling, I usually get like 3 or 4 of those, because that should just not be happening. Like, they're... like, a lot of people in my draft should want that card.
Yeah, no, agreed entirely. Cool, I think that brings us to the end of the draft chat. But Karan, you have been playing quite a lot of Sealed. How's that been going for you?
It's been tough.
Really?
The format's very bomb-heavy, man. So I played a Sealed, what they call the Super Qualifier. Basically, a PDQ with, you know, instead of a person getting the invite, 2 people get the invite. So I played one last night, rather poorly decided to join one that started at 10 p.m. And my pool was pretty bad. I think the only rare that I played was Karuga, but I played it in my deck, not as my companion, because my pool just allowed me to build an aggressive curve type cycling theme deck. And so I was able to, at least I could throw in Karuga. So it was pretty weird.
Was it a Jeskai based deck?
No, it was blue red. Blue red, okay. And I splashed black. I had another rare because I splashed black. I had the Extinction Event, which is, So I played that, and it was so frustrating because I was at 5-2, and I needed to win out the last 2 rounds to have a chance to, you know, to top 8. And then in round 8, which was just after 5 a.m. I remember specifically, because my opponent was like, "Hey, there's only a round to go," and I'm like, "Yeah, I'm like, I really need it." He's like, "Where are you?" I'm like, "South Africa." I'm like, "It's 5:15 a.m. I'll remember that exactly. Anyway, so my opponent in round 8 at 5 o'clock in the morning plays Narset Karuga, the Eudora guy that comes back with haste, Obosh, and
So there's a reason why you're playing him at that point, like, in the tournament.
No, like, these were all fantastic. Like, I'm like, why have you lost? Why do you have 2 losses? I don't understand. Like this is the thing. You just played all these, like, overpowered cards. Yeah, I was 5-2 at that point. And I'm like, oh, I hate life. Why do I have to play this guy, Mr. Broken Deck guy, at 5 in the morning? So, yeah, I feel like the format's very bomb heavy, and the companions push you further in that direction. And as Anthony was saying, you know, in draft, it's already difficult in this draft format to have great aggressive decks. So in sealed, it's almost impossible. So, you know, you don't get punished for playing things like Karuga and sealed. It's just this uber bomb. So I think Seal Deck is particularly bomb heavy. It gets pushed further in that direction because of the likes of the companions and their effect. But yeah, I've been enjoying it. It's good competition. The level of play is outstanding. Like every time I make a mistake, I'm punished immediately. You know, it's good because it keeps me on my toes, and I have been making a lot of mistakes, I must be honest, but I haven't been playing particularly well, but I note it's so noticeable. Every time I mess something up, I get punished. So yeah, the margins are really slim in this. The competition's great. I 3 days ago, a week ago, I was 6-1. And there was a bit of an issue that happened. It was a heartless act. I was 6-1, and I needed to win two of my next three to guarantee top eight. And I'm 6-1, and it's the deciding game, and I've got heartless act, and my opponent has a creature with a death touch counter on it, and so he's using ram through on his death touch creature to one of my big creatures. And so I go.
Can you, one second there, Karan? Can you just repeat that quickly? You broke up a little bit for me.
Oh, sure. So my opponent's got a Bootnapper with a Death Touch counter on it. He's using Ram Through, using the Death Touch creature onto like some big creature of mine in combat. And I go Heartless Act, choose the option, remove a counter, target the creature. So if you're familiar with MTGO, how it typically happens is you click on your spell, you select your option, then you choose your target, which is what I did. Now, this is the first time I've ever used Heartless Act for the remove counter option on JMTGO. So I did that, and then the next thing I know, I look at my cards in the graveyard, my Heartless Act's in the graveyard, and I'm like, what's going on? It didn't remove the counter, my card's in the graveyard, and now I've just lost this game because, you know, MTGO is bugged. So I thought. And so I complained to them, and they said, no, what actually happened was you are meant to click the creature a second time to remove the counter. And I'm like, I don't understand, but I've targeted it already, because MTGO people will know this. If you target something on MTGO and there's a selection, let's say it's an X or anything where you have to select a value, or, you know, adding, removing, whatever, on the dial up, the dial box on the left-hand side, a little thing will appear and it'll say tick up, tick down to select your value. Similar to how Arena is, you know, where Arena comes and it shows you when you're paying an X spell or whatever, it has a little pay value thing. So this is just coded really poorly as far as I'm concerned. And yeah, I ended up losing the match. And yeah, I just tilted. I tilted really hard again. It was one of those early in the morning type of situations. You played all this time. And like, I was convinced that, you know, either way, either it was coded poorly or it was bugged, and it just, you know, I lost from there. So yeah, that was pretty heartbreaking, and I ended up like 6-3, I think, or yeah. So it was pretty awful. So yeah.
Brian, you know, this is the reason I haven't come back to MTGO for the set, because like, I kind of want to play preliminaries. Like, it's fun to be able to have those competitive events when it, like, on demand, but like, I just felt like with this set, there's so many bizarre interactions that probably Magic Online is not going to, like, have them neatly done. They're just, like, there's too many weird things happening that I just know I'm going to end up losing games because, like, the weird things that happen on Arena are going to be even weirder on Magic Online because the coding's much less neat, you know?
Yeah, I mean, but that being said, like, the competition is just the variety of events now with the prelims and the super qualifiers, which are every day, you know, obviously depending on what formats you play. So if you're flexible and you don't mind playing across the formats, wow, it's such a great time to play MTGO. I mean, I'm just playing the limited events, because I'm lazy and I don't want to put in the work for constructed, the constructed events. But if you're a grinder and your goal is to sort of qualify, it's a pretty good time to do it. It really is. So yeah, for its faults and all its faults, MTGO is still there. And yeah, I was actually having this discussion. I was chatting to Claude. I know you guys know Claude. He won nationals, I don't know, years ago. You know, he just made the observation, you know, with the rand dollar exchange rate at the moment, if you've got an MTGO account, your account's, you know, stocked and it's
like doubled in value.
Yeah, so basically you've basically trading in dollars at the moment. So if I had to sell my MTGO account, which is something I'm considering doing, you know, it's a pretty good time to do it. So yeah, those of you out there, just have a look at your accounts and maybe check the values and could make some good money. You know, you could sell everything and buy back for a fraction of the cost if you want it at a later point, or you know, use that money for something nice. I don't know.
They could use that money to sign up to our Patreon accounts, which is a thing where we're going to have once this podcast is released, but more details on that coming. What were you going to say, Anthony?
No, I mean, I was going to say I would absolutely sell, although personally I'm not very good at that side of the sort of economic side of Magic. I've always end up selling too soon. but for me, the appeal of Magic Online right now is pretty much entirely limited. So like, I'd be like, well, why do I have a collection? Let me just get rid of these cards. Karan, how often are the limited super qualifiers?
So there was one last night, and I think the next one is tomorrow. So it's every 2 to 3 days on average.
Okay. And what's the entrance? Is it 36 or?
The limited prelims I think are 30, and I think the PDQs are 40.
Okay.
What's
the kind of money value of the actual cards in the set? Do you find that you often get some ticks back if you want to trade in the cards you open?
It depends. So before they banned temporarily suspended the Garuda. I was selling it at around 10. Luris was about 20. I was selling for 20. I know those were like the two money cards off the set, but I'll tell you now, I'll just pull up the price list. Yeah, but I think the prices have come down substantially in the last sort of couple of days as they tend
to
do.
I'm just thinking because, you know, like for myself and maybe a lot of people listening, like if people aren't really doing a lot of work right now, they might want to take cheaper option. That's not, like on Arena, I literally haven't paid anything and I've basically filled my whole Aquaria set just from drafting and doing reasonably well. Whereas
yeah, that's free like, draft take. Do you think that's an option on?
Do you think it's an option on Magic Online to like if you do reasonably well with these events to sort of go infinite?
No, it's not. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that it is. It's absolutely not. Like, you need to be. Magic Online is a. You need to be really, really consistent and play at a high level in order to not lose money. That's just a fact. So especially if you're playing limited. Limited is a sink. Constructed, of course, on the other hand, is different. You can be a good player in constructed, and it's relatively simple to sort of sustain yourself and just keep on going. But limited, you know, you're spending a lot of money, that $40 entry fee, and it's very difficult for you to get your money back. Obviously, it's a bit of a gamble depending on what you open and all of that sort of thing. So don't get into MTGO if your goal is to play limited and you think, oh, well, I'm just going to do what I'm doing in Arena. Not going to happen. Not going to happen at all.
The level of competition is very different.
Yeah, like, I mean, as that's I said... Sorry, I was saying I my free draft, and I've just been drafting ever since based on that free draft on my Arena account. Like, and that's easy. There's no way in hell you'll take one if I give you whatever, I think it's $12 or whatever the entry fee for a draft is on MTGO and say, yeah, go infinite. Not going to happen. Not going to happen.
I tried that years ago and it didn't happen.
Yeah.
When I used to draft MTGO a lot, there were some sets I did well at. And for me, doing well was like I would pay for two drafts and I'd get about 20, but it still wouldn't be like infinite. You know, like in Arena, it's been like pay for zero, get 100, which is. But I suppose what I'm asking is also for like in terms, because obviously you're talking about sealed events now, which is already quite different to drafting. What, like, in terms of the, like, the combined prize structure and, like, the value of the cards you're opening in one of those sealed qualifiers, like, how well do you have to do to sort of get your $40 of value back?
Because they're 6-3 is you get your money back and start making thereafter. It's about the 6-3 record.
Okay. So it's not something we'd encourage people to, like. It's not a smart investment, but, like, if you're quite a competitive player, it's something that you could, you know, you could get a few reps out of paying for one kind of thing.
Yeah, it's not an investment. And there's no such thing as it's not an investment at all. Like, you will get, like, if you have, your only experience of a competitive Magic is Arena and you want to come across and play MTGO, this is not it. This is for, and these events I'm talking about, these are for people who are sort of Grand Prix level, you know, Grand Prix level grinders, kind of thing, you know, at the very least. Like, you know, don't be like FNM end boss and then think you're going to, you know, put your money in and just kill it on TGO. That's not how it works. And I'm not trying to be dismissive of anyone. It's just that's the reality, because it'll end up being a very expensive lesson.
But
quickly,
if you have
you know?
The money, it's a good way to get good.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. If you've got money, then just you want to get good at Magic, MTGO. Forget anything else. Play MTGO. Just throw yourself, immerse yourself into MTGO. If money isn't an issue, 100%, that's the way to go. And any format, it's available, and they're actual competitive events. It's not like this nonsense of the Arena where it's like, oh, there's a competitive event, but it's like win booster, I don't know, card sleeves and stupid gold and whatever. Yeah, you know, there's good stuff to win. I mean, I played a preliminary the other day. I played a Hall of Famer, a Magic Online finalist, and another Pro Tour like veteran in my five rounds. And that's just a typical day on MTGO, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. So if people want to up their game a bit, they can go to MTGO. But if you still want to play with us in the kiddie pool a bit, I guess MTG Arena still. But that's what we've been saying for a while on this podcast, anyway. But that's the thing. It depends on how good you want to get. It depends on who you want to play against. If you're okay with playing against, you know, a few softer players and drafting with people who don't value cards as, you know, correctly as they should, you aren't going to necessarily improve as much as you could than if you were playing, you know, at an 8-person pod where every single player is a top player, where you're the worst player at the pod. Then you're obviously going to get better in those situations. But it is just the cost difference is immense. Like, we're all talking now. We got that free draft token, and none of us have put money in. Like, I'm on, what, about 9 or 10 drafts now? And I have, like, I'm up on gems. Like, that's crazy. And that would never, ever, ever, ever happen to me on MTG.
I've literally collected the whole set. I've got 4 copies of every card in the set, and I haven't paid money. So I haven't used a wild card yet. You know, I'm now sitting on like hundreds of wild cards, and so
cracky.
It's a pretty nice way to just.
Yeah, so that's the thing. If you want to get familiar and you want to get decent at the game, Arena is obviously the way to go. And there's so much free value there. You know, getting to draft for free with other people, the experience is so dope. Like, just that you can do that now, man. Like, that's something we've been wanting forever. Having a free option, essentially, to be able to draft is unheard of. You know, you had to do that on X-Mage, like, back in the day. So now that that is there, I think that's going to give a lot of people just the opportunity to draft more and play Limited more and understand it more. So when we do go to the stores, the average level of, you know, Limited will be better. Because that's the thing. It's also a lot of people are playing now. They're playing against better players for the first time. You know, a lot of them are now drafting against people who know what's up, and they haven't been doing that. They've been doing that against a lot of the players. Well, they haven't. They've been doing it against bots. So they haven't really understood things quite the same way. The packs don't break the same way. You know, the picks aren't the same. So, yeah, I think Arena is going to slowly improve the general player base. But if you yourself want to get really good, you've got to go to MTGO.
It's going to be much better once they allow us to, like, create our own pods, which I expect will eventually happen, right? Where you'll just invite 8 of your own people and like draft together an arena. Because I think every pro team would just use it at that stage.
Well, that option doesn't exist on MTGO all these years later. So I don't know.
That's true. Maybe they don't want to. Maybe it's. Cool. So I also wanted to say I agree with what Karan said that like obviously the average level of player you play on MTGO is higher, and so from that perspective, it's going to help you more to improve. There are some things that people can do to help themselves improve, even just playing on Arena quite a lot. And one of the things that I think not enough people do is using the third-party stat collecting software.
I think
that's like super, super valuable. So I use MTG Untapped and...
Same.
But just because I think people have like significant biases about how they're doing with certain decks or certain cards or certain versions of decks, and having that sort of objective statistics captured so that you can look at it and be like, well, actually, this is my win rate with this deck, and actually, I'm winning way less on the draw, or those sorts of pieces of information are really nice, and it is one of the benefits of Arena that there's a lot of them out there, and there's a lot of like really good data you can get on your play.
Yep, I agree 100%. I've been using Untapped since they've made it available for Arena, and it's been incredible in like knowing which decks are actually working, which ones aren't. And you've obviously got to give yourself time though. Like you've got to lose like 20 matches to really know like if a deck sucks. Not really, but you know what I mean. Like you can't just play a deck and lose 5 matches in a row like I've done and Karan and I have chatted about before and just say this deck sucks. You know, you do have to give yourself real options though when it comes to that. But like you say, when you're busy playing and you're actually winning like 45%, but you think you're 60%, that's where that really, really helps a lot.
Yeah, and like I remember, I also installed the Untapped thing quite recently, a couple months ago, Anthony, and I was playing that artifact, 2-mana artifact that copies spells. Anyway, that Timur adventure deck.
Yeah,
and it was a bizarre thing. I found out that I was winning something like it was close to 90% on the play. It was high 80s, and on the draw it was really low. It was like I don't know 50-odd%. On the draw. So, you know, it just gave me some insight. Obviously, I was doing something really wrong, and maybe I was taking the really poor lines when I was on the draw, or, you know, how I was approaching it. So that's a really cool piece of information to have, because that's something that you typically wouldn't know. You might know your total win percentage, even if it's somewhat accurate. But the play draw thing is huge, I think.
Yeah, there's a lot of useful information in there. Well, I wanted to thank you, gents. I think that brings us to the end of this podcast. It's been a good one. There's been a ton of information shared here. And I'm sure if anyone's listened to this podcast, no matter who they are, they've got something out of it they can take with them that's going to help them improve this week. Anthony, where can people find you on the internet?
You can follow me on Twitter at Scantzor, S-C-A-N-T-Z-O-R. And if you want to, you know, email me or whatever, you can find all that information on my Twitter.
Okay, perfect. Karan?
Karan C on Twitter and Insta.
Cool. And then you can find me at BobnessMonster on Twitter. I am Almost Perfect Bob on Instagram. And you can find us at MTG Sharks or Sharks MTG. Just put those two words together. You should find us somewhere. And like I said earlier, we have set up a Patreon account. Karan and I were chatting. We've got some plans for what we want to do with the podcast going forward. We'd like to actually do some live streaming video and various other options, you know, that are available to us when it comes to this podcasting thing. We want to do it more often. We want to do it more frequently. So one of the ways we can do that is if we get a bit of income from it. So we're going to set up a Patreon account. I've literally got the page open here. And by the time this podcast goes out, there should be a link to that with this podcast. So if you want to support us, if you feel like you got some good information out of this, we would love that. And it would definitely help at this time. And like I say, it'll just make the podcast better. It'll just give you guys more options when it comes to the podcast. And yeah, we'll make South Africa's best MTG podcast even better. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again next week.